On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For a nation of immigrants, America has always had a complicated relationship with immigration. Some came in splendor, some came in chains, everything in between. In the half century since Ellis Island closed, immigration and the immigrant experience have changed massively again. So, do we still want to absorb? Do they still want to assimilate? Are we open to a permanent underclass? In a globalized world, do immigrants ever really now leave the old country? Up next on Point, as Washington debates, we'll look at the realities of the new American immigrant experience. Joining me first today from Washington is James Pethakoukas, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. He's been covering the blazing immigration debate in Congress. James, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks.
So this is not going to be settled this week. Walk us through what looks like it may clear the bar in the big deal that the president and some senators worked out, and what looks like it's DOA or in for massive transformation.
Well, I mean, I think I think time is sort of not the friend of this bill, which is why originally they wanted to get this thing up and voted, you know, ASAP, and now it's going to be pushed past Memorial Day into June, and I mean that. They didn't want that because they realized that there's opposition on the left. There's loads of opposition on the right, and that's clearly building, and there are going to be plenty of provisions that are going to be plenty of grist for people to attack. We have, and the people on the right, they don't like the border security provisions because they don't trust that those things are actually going to happen.
These are the triggers that are supposed to go into effect with more of everything for security before the liberalization takes place.
That's right. I mean, they have no confidence that that's ever going to happen. On the left, unions, they don't like this huge guest worker provision because to them that just looks like a big pool of cheap labor that's never going to get unionized. So they don't like that, and there's already been a vote on that, which some senators try to decrease that from 400,000 down to 100,000, which has failed.
Mm-hmm.
On the right, they want this whole thing to be the whole immigration process to be more skills oriented and less about reunifying families. Again, they have no confidence that's going to happen. So at this point, there's probably more hostility toward it on the right, and the administration is really going to try to get what votes it can for this bill. Probably more from Democrats than Republicans.
Do the sponsors of this bill and the White House think they have a chance at getting it through then, or is this?
They think they have a chance of getting it through. I mean, it would have been better for them had this happened this week. The more people sort of read the bill, the more they can pick it apart, the more they can second guess this provision, that provision. So they want to get through as fast as possible. Now, as it's gone on, do they think they can get through? Yes, but I don't think they would give it a 60% chance. I think they would give it more likely than not, but not a lot more likely.
And to make that happen, what is it going to take? What may it take? If the fiercest criticism is from the right, first of all, if they don't believe that they're going to be more security guards, more security fence, and all the rest,
right?
How does that concern get assuaged?
Well, look. I mean, there are a lot of good reasons for Democrats to be for this bill. For one thing, we have an election coming up, and they think they're going to win. They think they're going to add to their seats in the House and Senate. They think they're going to have a Democratic president, and that new administration is going to want to deal with a lot of things. Climate change, health care. They don't want to deal with immigration.
In other words, they want to get it done now.
That's right.
Now.
They want to get it done now. So there's a lot. There's a lot going for it to happen right now and not push it off, and I believe that message is going to get out. There are a lot of things here that Democrats are really going to like.
But if the Republican opposition is even more fierce, how does that get addressed, James?
I'm sorry?
If the Republican opposition is even more fierce, how does that side of the equation get addressed?
I don't think you can. I mean, the really hardcore restrictionists, I don't think you can address it. I think they're not going to go for this because if they don't trust the administration, that any of these things are going to happen. They're certainly not going to trust whatever future administration, which could very well could be a Democratic administration. They're not going to go along for it. So it's really keeping what Republicans you can and making sure enough of the Democrats are on board in the end.
How many Republicans does that take at a minimum to get this through? What's the sense?
You know, I'm not sure. We had a vote on this guest worker provision, which got over 60 votes. So I think there was a a gelatinous 60 plus votes, probably not 70 votes, but probably just enough to squeak by.
And the White House, President Bush has been all for this. Feel the White House pushing hard on GOP members of Congress or not?
Are they going to push hard? Yeah, because this really comes from Bush, who has a theological, approval of immigration, which he's really an open borders guy. He certainly does not want to see a wall, which would be anathema to him. So they're going to do whatever they can, but ultimately, I think more of their efforts are going to be assuaging Democrats and getting them on board, because you're not going to get enough Republicans by themselves to do this.
So here we are, great big issue, and a 50-something percent chance, maybe.
51% nation, here we 50, go.
And a 51% chance maybe of it passing.
Maybe 51.5, I don't know.
Okay, we're parsing fine, but we see it's going to be a close thing. James Pethakoukas, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report in Washington. James, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
We're looking today at the new American immigrant experience as Congress debates all that. You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Irvine, California, is Ruben Rumbaut, professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. Since 1991, he's directed a study of the children of immigrants and another large-scale study of immigrants in Los Angeles. He's author of Immigrant America, A Portrait. He came to America in 1960 when his family fled Cuba. Ruben Rumbaut, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Mexico City, Mexico, is Hector Tobar, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's the author of Translation Nation. His parents emigrated from Guatemala. He grew up in Los Angeles. Hector Tobar, good to have you back. Thanks for joining us from Mexico City.
Thanks for having me.
Hector, give us the view right off the bat. Here you are from an immigrant family yourself. You're sitting in Mexico City. You know the American immigrant experience personally and intimately. Gee, where to dive in? Is it working today? Behind all of this, is there an immigrant experience from the immigrant perspective that is working at some level, any level? How do you see it?
Well, I think it's working for some people. I think people manage to make their way to the United States and to have a little slice of the American dream. To work in jobs that pay less and perhaps have less opportunity than they did a generation ago. But for people in Mexico, the United States represents social mobility. It represents escaping the class system here in Mexico that is much more rigid than it is in the United States, a system that really in many ways resembles a caste system. And to go to the United States means the opportunity to purchase property, the dream that you might send your kids to college one day. But at the same time, I think that there's an awareness in Mexico that the immigrant experience in the United States has become increasingly shadowy. It's become much more difficult, that there's this mood in the United States sees Mexican immigrants, Central American immigrants, as the root of many social problems, and that anti-immigrant movement in the United States is reported almost daily here in the Mexican papers.
Ruben Rumbaut, in Irvine, it's a long time since Ellis Island closed its doors, 1954. The old inscription on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor." It's a long time since that was engraved as well. When you look out at the American immigrant experience, sort of then and now, has it always been this difficult, or are we in a new age here?
Well, I would say both. If anything has been a constant or predictable with respect to immigration to the United States, even as far back as colonial times, it has been the kind of xenophobic response that it has engendered among natives. More than 250 years ago, Benjamin Franklin was extremely concerned about the Germans in Philadelphia Germanizing us before we Anglified them. Over 100 years ago, Teddy Roosevelt was saying the same thing about hyphenated Americans and leading a campaign for 100% Americanism, as he would put it. And as Hector Tobar has just indicated, the anti-immigrant movement in the United States today is practically at an all-time peak. I mean, you have to go back throughout all of American history to find only so many other moments that have been so full of fear, xenophobia, and so on, as the present. On the other hand, immigrants continue to come to the United States. They come by hook or by crook. They are lured here. They are recruited here. And unlike the Pedestals poem that you mentioned, perhaps a new poem might say, bring us your Nobel Prize-winning physicist yearning to breathe free. This is something that is new in the new era of mass migration. There's a very high proportion of highly skilled, very talented scientists, managers, physicians, engineers, and so on that are coming to the United States. So you have a diversity of class origins that is unprecedented in prior immigration. But you also have refugees, asylees, labor migrants, migrants who are coming to meet the labor demands of a giant U.S. economy, but do so as undocumented immigrants because there are no immigrant visas anywhere near sufficient to meet the demand for low-skilled labor. So when you put all of these together, you see many points that are almost universal in the American immigrant experience, and others that are quite different and distinguish the present time from the past.
Let's hear a little bit of the debate that's been raging this week in the Senate. Yesterday, during a debate on the Senate floor, Senator Ted Kennedy, a big proponent, along with President Bush, of the new bill, said that immigrants have always played that pivotal role in American history.
We should remember in this debate that we are writing the next chapter of American history. Immigrants made the America of today and will help make the America of the future.
But Louisiana Republican Senator David Vitter, a huge critic of the new bill, said that the heart of it, maybe the Z visa that lets people stay on, find that path to citizenship, rewards illegal immigrants.
This Z visa is amnesty, pure and simple. It rewards folks for breaking the law. It lets them stay in this country without ever having to return to their homeland forever.
And then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid here warning that the immigration bill could have serious repercussions economically.
We must not create a law that guarantees a permanent underclass. People who are here to work in low-wage, low-skilled jobs, but do not have the chance to put down roots or benefit from the opportunities that American citizenship affords.
There we go. Hector Tobar, Ruben Rumbaut. Ruben, first to you. Just at a basic level, when you look out on this country, do you still see a country that wants to absorb immigrants? And do you see immigrants in the main that want to be absorbed, assimilated?
Absolutely. It's not only a country that wants to absorb immigrants, but that desperately needs to absorb immigrants for a variety of very deeply seated economic and demographic conditions. And as far as immigrants wanting to become integrated and incorporated in the United States, there's absolutely no question about it. You might say that immigration is the sincerest form of flattery. It's not only those in Mexico that Hector Tobar was talking about, the next-door neighbor with a 2,000-mile border and the biggest north-south wage gap in the world that are being lured to the United States by the demand by U.S. employers for their labor, but also many immigrant professionals all over the world from Africa, from Asia. There are very severe needs in nursing, for example, in California and elsewhere. And so you have people from the Philippines and you have engineers from India and so on that are coming to the United States. They're coming because a giant U.S. economy is generating a tremendous demand for labor, both at the very top of the U.S. labor hierarchy and at the very bottom as well. As far as wanting to incorporate, let's put it this way. In a world of 6.5 billion people, only 2% about are living outside the country of their birth. 98% of the world's peoples are stayers. Those who immigrate are a highly selected population. They're young, they're ambitious, they're risk takers, and they're willing to make many sacrifices to uproot themselves and start in a new country, often in a new language and culture and so on. And they do so because they very much want to become a part of it, and because they seek opportunity for their children, because they want to drop roots here.
Hector Tobar, we understand opportunity. It's clear that people want to come. They risk their lives very often on that southern U.S. border to get across the desert. But what's your sense? I mean, do you see a United States that honestly still wants to assimilate this great wave of immigrants? And do you see immigrants, and of course Latin American immigrants get pointed out here above all, do you see immigrants who really want to become Americans, USA Americans? Or is it to get a job but extend Latin American culture, political mentality, and the rest right up across the border?
Well, one thing I can do is compare the experience of my own immigrant parents in the 1960s and 70s in Los Angeles, when the California public education system was one of the best funded in the country, a model for the rest of the country. That institution, the California Public Schools, was, I think, one of the key elements in integrating myself and assimilating myself into American society and other people like me, other children of immigrants. I think that in the generation since then, public education has been defunded in California and elsewhere. I think it's obvious to anyone who visits a California public school that there's a lack of investment, that one doesn't sense when one takes one's child to a Los Angeles high school, not always at least, that this is an institution that's come to take my children and funnel them into the great American dream.
So what does that mean, that the pathway to assimilation has been withdrawn, but not the access to the job?
Exactly. At the same time, you have this low-wage sector that's ever-expanding, construction, all the service industry, that is increasingly dependent on immigrant labor almost everywhere in the country now. I mean, I've gone to Dalton, Georgia, Rupert, Idaho, Cincinnati, Ohio, and encountered little East Los Angeles-type communities in all those places because the American labor force at the lowest level, the American working class, is being slowly Latinized. We're creating sort of this kind of system like in Mexico, where there's a certain kind of person who sort of fills a low-wage job, and they're going to be stuck in that job, and their children are going to be stuck in that job, because there isn't the kind of social mobility in the United States that there was a generation ago. So I think that people who come from Latin America to the United States are expecting to find pathways to a middle-class life, and increasingly for all Americans, those pathways are a little steeper, a little harder to climb. And I think that people want to find that piece of the American dream. They want to learn English. English is a status symbol in Mexico, being able to speak English. They want their children to speak English. But I think they feel increasingly isolated and segregated and a little bit more farther removed from that dream.
So you're saying, just to question you there, you're saying if the U.S. Politics or political economy are being Latin Americanized, you're saying it's being done by Americans tolerating what? That kind of Mexican-style caste system in this country?
I would say that's exactly what's happening, and I think that's the future of the 21st century United States, unless there is a decision at the highest levels of policymakers, and also at the sort of state and regional level. And there are places in the country where they have invested a great deal of money, a great deal of funds in the public education system and in those institutions of assimilation. I write in Translation Nation about northern Georgia and the city of Dalton, where the local carpet manufacturers decide to invest a great deal of money in the public school system because they have this huge population of children arriving who speak only Spanish, and they see the need to sort of develop, you know, that population as an integral part of the community. But that, I think, is an exception to the rule. So I think, it's something that I see happening in Los Angeles increasingly, and I think it's going to be reproduced in other cities in the United States.
Ruben, how do you see it? It's never been easy for immigrants when they first come. The Irish famously had to fight for a long time to kind of stand up and get their due. So is this just a phase? Latin American immigrants will ultimately be integrated, assimilated culturally and economically, or do you fear, as Hector does, that we may be developing a kind of permanent caste system here?
It's not an either-or, but it certainly can include elements of both. The United States remains a land of opportunity. There's no question about it. The last people you have to tell that to are immigrants who come here for that opportunity. Those who are in their 30s, let's say, or older when they arrive, may not be able to learn English without an accent. But their children, especially those who arrived at younger ages, will pick it up instantly. And as our own research over the last 15 years, we've been following a panel of thousands of young people representing 77 different nationalities on both coasts, including all those from Latin America and Asia and so on. Within 10 years, they come to prefer English. They are far more proficient in English than in the language of their parents, and they use it with everyone, even including their parents. 90-some percent, by our last survey, across the board, without exception, whether foreign-born or U.S.-born children of immigrants, preferred English. However, absent that kind of investment in education, which today is far more important as a vehicle for social mobility than it ever was, and continuing the drumbeat of anti-immigration that was mentioned earlier, you're going to create a set of conditions that will lead a segment of that population, particularly those whose parents are not Nobel Prize winners and so on, into an underclass. It takes two to tango and to assimilate. Assimilation has always been not only about immigrants learning English and American ways and becoming identified with this society and so on. It has also been and hinges on the absence of prejudice and discrimination in the whole society, by the whole society, toward those immigrants.
But America's more diverse than ever, I would think more tolerant and open than ever. Maybe the numbers are just too big. 12 million illegal residents, we're told. Maybe it's just more than we can absorb.
12 million is not... those 12 million have been living among us for years and years. Yeah. They have already been incorporated. The perception of this huge number of outsiders and so on is largely a function of the way that perception has been manipulated in the media. That is not to say, needless to say, that 12 million people without legal status is not a serious social problem. It is, and in fact, the lack of a legal status is probably the number one impediment to their social mobility in the future. On the other hand, it's important to look back and place the current context in a historical perspective and appreciate the fact that there are many things about American society today that are much more conducive to integration of large numbers of immigrants than ever before. If you look at the role of Europeans 100 years ago, there was no welfare state at the time. The role of government was entirely different. The economy was different. There was no civil rights movement at the time. None of the things that have been achieved in the last 3 to 4 decades in that regard existed then. On the other hand, the level of inequality has been sharply increased since the 70s, and as Hector Tobar indicated, the race to the top today has to proceed through a much more narrow bottleneck than ever. It's about education, and those that are prevented from getting higher education are going to be in serious trouble.
Let me take a quick call here. Mary's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Mary, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Yeah.
What I would like to make a comment is that a lot of people talking about citizenship, it's not really citizenship for a lot of the foreigners. What are they looking for? It's for a driver's license and a permission to work. Once they have that, they make the money that they want, they pay their dues over here, they do everything, they go back home. Look for a foreigner that is 40 years old, 50 years old. They don't want to stay over here. They just want to make a little bit that they can pay for college for the kids and whatever they need, buy a house, the dream house, back in their country and go back.
A driver's license and a way back home, that's a whole new, well, not 100%, but in the main, that's a new idea of what immigration is. Mary, thanks for that call. Hector Tobar, not everybody's going back home, but what's Mary on to there?
Well, I think that that if the border were more open, there would be more of a flow back and forth than there was up until just a few years ago, where you could go to Nuevo Laredo on the border of Texas and meet people who were driving home for Christmas, for example, taking presents to the family, and that was sort of the ritual. Now, not everyone can do that because not everyone has their status, legalized. I think that one thing, touching on what she said, is that there are sort of many layers. Yes, people really need driver's licenses. That's one thing that people need. But there are just many layers of rights that sort of make your stay in the United States more like that of a full citizen, in the sense of having, you know, the right to live in a place and to work in a place, starting with a driver's license. I've been in many rural communities where the lack of driver's license makes people's lives horrible. They can't get to work without being harassed by the police. And at the other end of the scale, I've met many people traveling to the United States, giving talks about my book, who are, you know, everything about them is American. They speak fluent English. They were raised in the United States from the age of 5 or 6, and yet they don't have documents. They're not Americans. They have a Mexican passport. They have Mexican residency. And I think increasingly, the longer that there isn't a solution to this problem, that there isn't an immigration reform law, the larger that community of people who are living with as de facto Americans, paying taxes, going to school, doing work, building buildings for Americans, cleaning houses, etc., and who don't have the rights of Americans, is going to increase. And that, I think, is the danger of the 21st century United States, that we're going to have an increasingly large class of people who live amongst us, are de facto Americans, and don't have full rights. And the last time we had that in American life was in the aftermath of the Civil War, when the 15th Amendment granted rights to freed slaves, the right to be citizens, and yet it was a right that was eroded by Supreme Court decisions.
But Ruben, here's our caller Mary, who sounds like she may know something about it personally, saying all that people really want is a driver's license and a job. Then they'll go back home to a new house in Mexico or Guatemala or wherever it may be. Is that the American dream? Is that the American nightmare? Is that just what American employers want? But does it work for a political body, for a nation?
I would say to Mary that life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans.
Saving for that house in Mexico.
I wish I had a nickel for every immigrant that I have known, including our own family, that came with the plan of returning in just a year. We'll be home by Christmas, next year in Havana, next year in fill-in-the-blanks. We're going to just earn enough money to be able to go back to Mexico and buy that little house for retirement that we wanted, etc. But then life intervenes, things evolve, people have children, they drop down roots, and before you know it, it's 30 and 40 years later, and you're looking back in those plans, and they never quite came to fruition.
Let's go to East Lansing, Michigan, and Pat. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Well, I guess my opinion is that the whole immigrant debate is more of a diversion from some real issues that we aren't facing. Our labor in this country is part of now of a huge global labor pool, which is drastically lower than, with wages drastically lower than ours.
But doesn't that make immigration still front and center? I mean, you can send the jobs to China, but these are people coming here. There's a big difference.
Well, the people coming here are not taking jobs that we're exporting good jobs, and the people are coming here are not taking the good jobs. They're taking the jobs that nobody else wants. And I think that it's, if we put up a wall tomorrow that kept every immigrant out, that our wages and our jobs would still be ultimately going down. And that it's a lot easier to demonize an entire group of people, point to them, than to point at the structural issues that are causing our overall wage and labor problem.
Yeah, it's certainly in a new context when everything is flowing everywhere, including jobs and money and you name it. Pat, thanks for that. I want to bring one more voice into this conversation from Concord, Massachusetts. Peggy Levitt joins us. She's associate professor of sociology at Wellesley College, author of the new book, God Needs No Passport, Immigrants and the Changing American Religious Landscape. Peggy Levitt, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Look at globalization and the immigrant experience in this country today. There's some kind of dance going on there, but it's hard to make out exactly what it is. How do you see the relationship?
Well, I think the conversation so far has framed the debate as if we could just think about it in terms of what's happening in this country. And I think we really need to broaden the lens and see just as we understand that capital is global, we should also understand that labor or people are global. And so, what we're seeing is more and more people making homes for themselves in this country, but also staying connected to their countries of origin. And that, you know, becoming part of the United States and staying connected to your homeland are not antithetical. In fact, people who are able to do that are really good for this country because they're bridge builders and translators who can help us build the kinds of relationships and the kinds of economic relationships, the kinds of political relationships, the kinds of religious understanding that we need to do.
But haven't American immigrants always done that with the home country? You know, the fear is if the United States is just an address and not a political or cultural home, that immigration has fundamentally changed, that people, it's just a place to be, not a nation to be part of.
I think people have always done this, but that what we're seeing now is qualitatively different than in the past. So the fact that you have all kinds of new internet technologies, being able to travel back and forth, the fact that there is this culture that of pluralism in the United States that accepts more sustained ethnic ties changes the context in which this is taking place. I also think that, you know, you also have sending states that have become incredibly dependent upon the remittances that immigrants send and so are creating all kinds of opportunities and incentives for immigrants to be sort of long-term members without residence. In other words, stay connected, but also understanding that they're going to settle permanently in the places that they move to.
Hector Tobar, let me put it to you. Is there a contradiction here? In a globalized time, it's easier to keep one foot in the old country and one foot in the new. Is that at odds with our historic sense of what assimilation means, what becoming a U.S. American means? Or is that an opportunity we can embrace without losing a sense of nationhood and shared political, cultural identity?
Well, the answer is yes and no to that question. I think that when you come, and it's really true that in Mexico, in El Salvador, there is increasingly a connection with the United States. You can walk two blocks in Mexico City, talk to 10 people, and the chances are 9 of them will have a relative in the United States. The same goes for Guatemala. El Salvador is a place that where remittances is increasingly sort of a challenge to the national identity. A lot of people are afraid in El Salvador that the country is losing its sense of nationhood because so many of its citizens have gone to work in the United States and the country has become so dependent on the remittances. At the same time, people who travel, who make that journey from Guatemala to the United States, like my father did, or from Mexico City to the United States, those people are transformed. They become different people. I've seen this in my own family. My father went to Los Angeles from Guatemala. My uncle stayed behind. My father evolved into a different kind of person. My father is, in many ways, now more American than he is Guatemalan after 40 years in the United States.
Is that still happening with new arrivals, or does the greater ease of sort of going back and forth mean, you know, mean no, that the remittances that go back are the resources? I mean, you clearly were raised up and made it big time, but a lot of people aren't. We see the statistics. Are the remittances part of that problem today, Hector?
But I think that by keeping on framing the debate in terms of assimilation versus non-assimilation or either or, you know, American or non-American, we're missing the boat because the world is a global world. And to ask people to make a choice, it's not a choice. Those two positions are not antithetical.
Right.
We need people who can be in the world and live in both places and help the United States, you know, export values of democracy, help alleviate poverty. Right.
But Peggy, Hector Tobar, wait a minute. I want to put this to Peggy. Hector Tobar is saying by creating what may be a permanent underclass here, we're becoming more like a Latin American economy and maybe even more like Latin America politically. Never mind if it's the immigrants bringing that's what's evolving here. I mean, doesn't the political culture still matter? Doesn't some assimilation of core values still matter?
I don't think that immigrants aren't assimilating core values. That's my point.
No,
the point is that you can assimilate. People very much want to be part of this country. In all my research, I haven't met anybody that hasn't been grateful for the opportunities that were provided to this country. And so embracing those values, mm-hmm. even if you embrace them selectively, doesn't mean, and still being concerned about the people back home and trying to help people back home aren't antithetical positions. You can feel very proud to be part of this country and very grateful for the opportunities that you've gotten.
So there's
and still be sending charity and investing and be active in Dominican politics.
There's a great big global perspective. Let's test it with listeners. Pablo's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Pablo, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
All right, what do you see? Yeah.
Well, I'm an immigrant. I came to the States around 20 years ago, and 15 out of those 20 years I was living here as an illegal immigrant.
Yeah.
I'm finally legal now, and...
Congratulations.
Thank you. And just when that happened, I'm actually planning on moving back to Brazil, which is my country of origin. And
so what does that mean, Pablo? Are you the new global citizen that Peggy's describing? You can live here, live there, it doesn't matter, or you have both?
I agree with Peggy. In many ways, I feel much more American than I would Brazilian, just because of the opportunities that the United States have presented me with. But at the same time, you know, the decision to go back to Brazil is just, you know, part of my life. I mean, as if I was born here, I could very well decide to live somewhere else. And the country doesn't really mean that I'm not, I don't appreciate the things I got here. It's just a next step in my life, personally. And the other comment I would like to make is you just mentioned that, you know, if we are or if we are not creating a second-class citizen type of deal here in the States. And when you say that, it makes me think that whatever the Congress is going to prove now is going to determine that. But the second class already exists. It's here. It's those 12 million people that already live here. Now it's just a matter of how we're going to deal with them or not, I guess.
Yeah, no kidding. We're trying to get out of denial and into the clear light of day. Pablo, that's really great. Congratulations. Good luck wherever you end up, and thanks for that. Let me get one call from Hartford, Connecticut. Derry, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Certainly.
I just wanted to quickly share my experience. I am from Guatemala. Mm-hmm. I was born there, and I moved to the United States when I was 14.
Okay.
I finished high school here. Went to college and then to law school. I speak English fluently with a little bit of an accent, but
it's beautiful.
And I feel as American as anybody else. I have not become a citizen yet because you have to wait several years after you get your green card, but I certainly look forward to do it this year. So there are a lot of people like me. I don't think I'm unique. I think that a lot of people assimilate into this country.
Derry, was it easy for you? Did you feel this country welcoming your family, welcoming you, reaching out to assimilate you, or did you have to, you know, climb a tall hill?
Well, I think at the time that I moved here with my family, things were a little bit easier. That's not to say they were easy. I think public school had a good role in our assimilation. And my neighborhood was actually very friendly. And I do think that I felt welcomed. And, but it wasn't easy. When we first moved here, we had temporary permits. I was able to work while I was in college, but I wasn't able to save, borrow money. And
right.
Given how expensive college was, and, you know, my parents didn't make that much money, it was very, very difficult.
Right.
But
well, that's a very American experience you shared right there. But now you say, as American as anybody else, and we hear the pride in that. Ruben Rumbaut in Irvine, you know, we're hearing this sort of range. Maybe there's a new model we should have in mind, not just the fully assimilated, not going home immigrant, but the bicultural immigrant. Does that work politically for the home country, for the USA?
Well, and it is also what Peggy Leavitt was talking about, as an ideal. I remember that just last December, for example, the Iraq Study Group mentioned that one of the most serious problems that they were identifying was the fact that in the American embassy in Baghdad, out of 1,000 American staffers, only 6 could speak fluent Arabic. The absence of fluent bilingualism in the United States, which is ironic because the United States has absorbed more bilingual people than any country on earth, and yet the United States is also a language graveyard. In no other country in the world has it switched to monolingual English.
But surely bilingualism, I mean, as much as we need it, surely there's got to be a lot more to becoming an American than that, learning English but having the home language at the same time.
Absolutely. What I was getting to is, and what all the last several callers, I think, have indicated in various ways, is that they're underlining the complexity of contemporary immigration. Immigrants are not just of one cloth. The most highly educated people in the United States today are immigrants. The least educated people in the United States today are immigrants. The highest and the lowest of anything you can imagine are to be found among the 30-some million immigrants in the United States today. And so you cannot reduce it to a single formula, to a 30-second soundbite, to a single policy that the center of the House can pass. It is far more complex than that, and as Peggy Leavitt has indicated, and as Hector Tobar has indicated, we have to understand this in a global context. So much of what is called globalization today is really Americanization. English is a global language. Mm-hmm. It is the official language, for all intents and purposes, of much of the world. Many immigrants are pre-Americanized before they come here, and the extension of the United States in the post-World War II period throughout the world mm-hmm. to its position of contemporary hegemony means that it's not just immigrants that are coming here and maintaining ties back home, but that the United States is going into every country in the world and creating links with the United States in the process.
So people Americanized before they even arrive here. Peggy Leavitt, you know, Samuel Huntington famously wrote a couple of years ago that, you know, we would lose our American identity in this flood. It would just be gone. This global community that you picture and describe and that we can see around us, where does it leave issues of national identity, national political ideology, national belief?
I think that we have to stop seeing national identity as being a victim to or being somehow threatened by the fact that people are able to be bilingual, bicultural, live with feet in two worlds. You know, when Paulo, the caller from Framingham, mm-hmm. goes back to Brazil, you can bet that he's going to be both contributing to Brazilian society mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. also being an ambassador for America. Pushing American values and the things, the social remittances that he will be introducing there, because there are things that he observed. And so I think that we're wrong to keep insisting that mm-hmm. national identities are formed by people living inside of national borders, and we need to keep those borders mm-hmm. strong. This is a global mm-hmm. world. If we're really concerned about remaining economically competitive, about, you know, spreading ideas of democracy that we're over in Iraq fighting for, then we need to open up our eyes, open up our lenses, and see mm-hmm. how we can contribute to strengthening those ideals and values that we hold so dear.
And yet it's clearly a lot to ask. People really struggle with doing exactly what you're describing. Hector Tobar, we've just got a minute here. You're the young immigrant. You've seen a lot. You're in Mexico City right now. What's your greatest hope for how this may evolve in the U.S., and what's your greatest fear?
Well, my hope is that there will be an immigration reform that will allow millions of people who are de facto Americans to become eventually full citizens. And I think that gradually the United States is going to be transformed by Latino immigrants, just the way it was transformed by German, Irish, and Polish immigrants in another century. That's the American story, is that American national identity is not a static thing. It's something that is constantly being sort of redefined. And now we have, living in the United States, millions of people who consider themselves Americans, who feel American, who've been transformed. Yes, they have a part of their soul that's in Guatemala, a part of their soul that's in Mexico, but they've also been transformed by the United States, and they're going to continue to transform it.
And if that bill isn't passed, if this doesn't all come to pass, what's the downside vision, in brief?
Post-Reconstruction United States, a century in which millions of people live among us as non-citizens.
There's a picture. Hector Tobar with the LA Times in Mexico City. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Peggy Leavitt at Wellesley College, author of the new book, God Needs No Passport. Peggy, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Ruben Rumbaut at the University of California, Irvine, author of Immigrant America. Thanks for being here, Professor.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.